Brenda. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Well, since I've talked to some of you before, I might as well just start right in and say, what is it that makes somebody want to get a world record? Well, it's just a question of me. I was a hanger-on in somebody else's dream. So, let's start at the beginning. My late husband used to have bought a plane from Beechcraft. The plane was called Starship One. It's a very unusual plane because it was one of the first Boeing that had been built out of entirely carbon fiber, which is this that I'm holding in my hand. At that point, I have to just look at a few moments. The Starship flies at a speed of 385 miles an hour. I'll put it back into miles an hour because when I worked out some of my what I thought was very good calculations, it didn't really seem to compute very well, so I decided I'd better go back to miles rather than kilometers. Okay, so 385 miles an hour. It has a range of 1,673 miles and flies at an altitude of 41,000 feet, which in other words is around 7.75 miles high. Who were we, these people who wanted to make this trip? Well, it was my late husband, Eustace, who loved to fly but didn't have his pilot's license. There was a guy called Jim Campbell who was our pilot, but he was also a very good friend, and myself. So once we decided that we wanted to do this, and why did we want to do it anyway? Well, the reason we wanted to do it was, number one, it was built out of carbon fiber and nobody else had done it. Number two, it was what was called a pusher plane, which means, and you may be able to see it here, you can just vaguely see little lines here where it had the propellers way in the back of the plane. So it was what was termed a pusher plane. And a pusher plane has never flown around the world. So we said, let's do it, why don't we? Might be fun. Well, we turned it into a try for the Guinness Book of Records. Plus, it was also a business trip because my husband at the time owned a magazine, two magazines actually, one called Golf Illustrated and one called Fairways and Greens, which are both on the table and you're welcome to have a look at afterwards. Having decided we were going to do it, we contacted Guinness to ask them, what do we have to do to get a record? And they came back to us and said, it's really very simple. All you have to do is, every time you stop at an airport, take a picture of the plane in the foreground and the name of the airport in the background and send us the undeveloped film. And if we agree that this is really what you've done, you will have your record. So we said, yeah, well, this sounds too difficult to do, so why don't we? So we then set about trying to find out what you have to do to fly around the world. Well, first of all, you have to get permission to fly through every country, and that takes a bit of time. Not only did you have to get permission, but you also have to find out whether they have, well, in other words, if you're going to stop in that country, you need to know whether they have refueling facilities and facilities for, if you have a problem, whether you can repair something. Having got all of those, you then go to your next, which is working out your actual route and everything else. And then the last day before you go, you find out what the weather's going to be like, because that's pretty important too. So, on May the 4th, 1992, November 1-4, Victor Papa started out on its trip around the world. First stops were, in fact, several that day, because we went to Milwaukee, we went to Wilmington, and we went to Boston. Stopped in Boston for a very short time, and then went on to Goose Bay, Nova Scotia, where we stopped the night. Next morning...
Stopping in Phoenix.
I'm sorry, did I say that we... I didn't. I forgot to tell you that we stopped in Phoenix, Arizona. We left from Phoenix, Arizona, which is where we were living at the time. You got that all pretty loud on your mouth?
Yeah.
Okay. So, first overnight stop, Goose Bay, Nova Scotia. Next morning, we were planning on refueling in, and it's got a lot of pronunciation, so I'll just say it was Nisarsarac, Greenland. But the weather was so good that day, and the winds were behind us, But we said, heck, why are we going to bother to stop there when in fact we could just go right on to Reykjavik, Iceland, which is in fact what we did, and it was quite a long trip, and I think we didn't have too much gas left in the tank when we got there, but anyway, we got there. We had some great friends that we met there. They took us around Reykjavik, gave us an enormously fascinating lunch, which was their local speciality, cod cheeks. I'd never had that before, but it was very interesting. Cod cheeks.
Just the cheek of the
cod. Yeah.
Oh, the cheek.
The cheek of the cod. Yeah. But I did learn one interesting thing there, that they don't have any real heating bills in Iceland, because Reykjavik sits on a thermal spring. So they're tapped into all of this heated water, and it's just piped straight into everybody's houses. I'm thinking to myself, what great way to heat your house. Anyway, they managed to convince us while we were there having lunch to take their son on to England, because he was on his way there. So he turned up at the airport. Oh, he had so much luggage, I was wondering how we were going to get him in. In fact, I actually honestly thought he'd got the kitchen sink as well. But, we got him on, a bit like sardines, but he was there, he was on, and we dropped him off in Leeds, made a quick stop in Birmingham, and then stopped overnight in Cambridge, because that was just outside where my parents lived. And then in the morning, we had a little trip we had to make, and we were looking, actually we had a discussion, and we said, well, what should we do? Having figured out that it was going to take us 4 hours by road, we checked how much it would take us by starship, and since it was 24 minutes, we decided it was a no-brainer, we'd go by starship. So we went over to Chester, very quick flight. From Chester, we went on to Paris. We stayed in Paris overnight. And then, at this point, I'll tell you, in fact, I think I already told you, my husband owned these magazines. So the next day, we went over to what most English people call Annecy, something like that. Actually, it's called Annecy. And we went over there to visit the TaylorMade factory, TaylorMade Golf Clubs, and had a very interesting tour around the factory. Especially, they were probably one of the first people to have robots, and they had a row of these red-painted metal robots that were swinging a golf club. I mean, just, if I could have watch a perfect swing, that was it. They were. I wanted to stay there forever and just watch these things. Anyway, we have to go on because a long way still. So after lunch we left and we went over to Bordeaux where we stayed with friends for the night, and Jim took the plane back to Paris because with a great big grin on his face he said to us, you know, the starship's a little bit like a Ferrari. Every time you take it out it needs fine tuning. So he went back up to Paris and tried to fix what in fact I learned later was a slightly not too working well autopilot. He picked us up the next morning, and we take a quick trip over to Lisbon, Portugal, where my husband had a 3-hour meeting, and then took off in the air again, up to our next stop, which was supposed to be Palermo, Sicily. But, halfway over Spain, the door seal blew. Now, I don't know if any of you know what that means. But you may, if you play golf, remember Payne Stewart and the ghastly accident he had when everybody on the plane was killed and it went on flying for hours and hours. The cause of that accident was a door seal blown. So basically what happened was oxygen quit because we knew what had happened. SOS down to the closest control towers, we must make an emergency landing. It turned out that Barcelona was the nearest place we could stop. So we landed at Barcelona, tried to fix it, but unfortunately couldn't. So we took off again on our way to Palermo and just had to fly at much lower altitudes where it was safe. We stayed in Palermo overnight and went on to Cairo the next morning. Cairo was just a refueling stop, but I must admit it was a bit of an eye-opener, because when we opened the door of the plane, here we get sort of met by kind of think what it felt like to me, kids of about 18 years old, each armed with pistols and rifles, and they were standing at the end of every gangway to every plane that was landed, that was on the tarmac. I was like, wow, what is it? So 20 minutes later we were all a little bit happy to get out of there and get on our way again. And on our way again was over the deserts. And while we were flying over all this big desert on our way to the Arab Emirates in Dubai, we were flying over Riyadh, and in fact we could see on the radar screen quite a lot of the other places, which in fact in 1992 was not very long after Desert Storm. It was one of those things where I'm thinking, well, I'm glad I'm in the air, I'm glad the air is finished, but heck, I'm glad I did it, you know, because it makes me feel like I've done something a little bit more special just because it's so close to Desert Storm. We didn't get hit with a rocket or something. We landed in Dubai fairly late in the evening, and the hotel had sent us a taxi to meet us. The taxi didn't really quite expect that we were going to have luggage, but we'd taken golf clubs with us, obviously being a golfer. So what with the bags and golf clubs and stuff, there was a bit of luggage, and this taxi driver got his boot absolutely full of flowers. So Jim, the pilot, and myself were stuck on the back seat, and then we piled all the flowers on top of us and stuck the luggage in the trunk, which was okay, except that, you know, when you're riding in one of these stuff, it was a little bit bigger than just a taxi. It wasn't a limo though, but anyway, big enough. And I just sat there with all these flowers on top of me thinking, well, you know, all I need underneath me is a coffin or something. Anyway, we stopped in Dubai, I think it was for about 3 days.
Has the door
seen
you?
No.
Oh?
No.
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 I thought I missed a bit.
No, you haven't missed a bit at all. It wasn't planted for a long time.
It doesn't seem for a while.
In Dubai, the morning after we arrived, Jim went back out to the airport because we'd had a door seal sent to us by Beechcraft so that he could try to mend it. Well, he spent all that day trying to mend it, and at one point he had to go and get a tool. And so he said to the Arab helper that he had with him, "I need to lock the plane." And the Arab says, "Oh, no, we don't have any theft here. If they caught you in our plane, they'd cut off your hands right there in the plane." So that you'd know they'd never steal again. One thing, of course, I was a bit bloody, but never mind. Anyway, while he was doing all that, Yusti and I played the Dubai, well, not the Dubai course, but the first course, the golf course that had ever been built in Dubai, which was quite far out of the city itself, but absolutely gorgeous, very like Arizona golf courses. But the clubhouse was fascinating. They built it to look like a series of Bedouin tents. And if anybody watched golf on television, you might have seen it because they were playing the Dubai Open about 2 weeks ago there. And was it Tiger Woods who won? But I think so. Anyway, we spent another day out, which I spent mostly lying in that lovely, very heavy salted water so that you just got your hands behind your head and went to sleep. It was great. Jim went back to the airport again to try and do some more fixing of the plane. This time he was wearing shorts because it was so damn hot there. The Arab helper looked at him when he got to the plane and said, you know, it's against the law here, A, to show your skin, and B, it is very, very against the law to ever have an operation unless it's life-threatening. Jim was 6'7" and had had numerous operations on his knees because he was a basketball player and obviously damaged whatever it was. So he went rather quickly to the loo and put his trousers on, and he caused a riot. Anyway, leaving Dubai behind, this I have to read my notes for because it was such a comedy that I couldn't remember it all. So, we'd arranged for a handler because you're not allowed to go through customs on your own. He arrives downstairs, we're upstairs. He has to take his car all around the airport to get upstairs, pick us up, go back around the airport again, then walk back upstairs to get the luggage through x-ray. A 30-minute wait while the customs officials changed shifts. Another 7 minutes per passport under the officials' noses. We were fit to be tagged with a really tight schedule and a very long way to go that day. Handle then takes us to the duty free and says he will see us in 30 minutes. We say, oh no, please, we say, just take this to the plane. Upset but finally persuaded, he takes us out to the plane where we found a demented gym. He asked for the plane to be out of the hangar by 6 a.m. By 7 it was still in the hangar. Jim finally had to push it out by himself, then discovered it hadn't been refueled as requested. That took another hour, by which time we were all chanting at the bit. That's not the end of the saga. Some foreign ports have different rules. Most airports, you start your engines and then contact the control tower and ask if you can have permission to taxi to the runway. In Dubai, it's against aviation rules to start your engine before getting permission from the control tower. So here we were, November 1-4, Victor Papa, permission to start engines. November 1-4, Victor Papa, permission to start engines. On and on for about 15 or 20 minutes before finally they answered and gave us the OK. And by then, wheels off, thank God we all started airborne again. 4.5 hours later we were landing in Bombay. That was just a supposedly quick refueling stop because we were going a lot further that day. A quick, what we assumed would be 20 minute refueling stop turned into 2 hours, so we had by then a seriously demented gym yet again steaming at the nostrils because he couldn't get going. But we were finally, after 2.5 hours or whatever it was, glad to get going. Flew over the southern tip of India and landed for a semi-refuel in Colombo, Sri Lanka. That was a fun stop, even if it was only for a very short time, because there was quite a few of the Colombian staff wanted to visit the plane, and so we let them all come around and everything else, and Jim's standing there at the door, and all these guys are coming up the plane, going back down again. And when we took off, Jim said to me, he said, I've never felt so like Gulliver in all my life. They were tiny. Anyway, we took off, and at that point we were on our way to Phuket, in Wadi Islands off the Malaysian coast. It was getting pretty late in the day by then, because 4.5 hours, 2.5 hours, plus 2 hour stop and everything else. It must have been about 7 o'clock when we took off. It's getting dark. Clouds coming up. Big clouds coming up. Even big clouds coming up. Thunderheads coming up. Ow, don't like that much. So what actually happened was when we land ourselves in the middle of a horrendous thunderstorm, lightning crashing all around us, us trying to wheel ourselves around thunderheads because they're desperately dangerous. And at the same time, radioing the control tower to find out whether we were expected and whatever, getting no reply whatsoever. 20 miles out, still no reply. 10 miles out, still no reply. We at that point were basically flying on fumes because the weather was all in front of us, so we were pushing against it and using a lot more fuel and still flying low, so you need even more. I can only tell you that I think it was about 3 miles out, we saw the lights on the vanish that go on, and I've never been so damn glad in my life because I was really quite sure I was going to be swimming with a shark. We landed, and apparently they'd opened the airport specially for us. They did close when they were being especially nice, but what nice people. It was just really fascinating. They were just charming to us. But again, we had to take a taxi. Now this taxi was something else because he had, well, I guess it was probably what you might call an old taxi, and the back seat was either very used or worn out, because where the seat cover went, the underneath support of that had, I think, just disintegrated, because I was sitting on the cushion right on top of the exhaust pipe. And by the time we got where we were going, I was extremely red, and a few days later I peeled. So, you know, I got quite nicely burnt. Anyway, He dropped us off and unloaded the baggage and just dumped it in the street and stuff. And we thought, well, this is funny, this is not the hotel. Where are we? Well, it turned out that we weren't anywhere except that there was one house. So we knocked on the door of this house and this nice Chinese man comes and we sent those out, managed to make ourselves understood. And they were just so sweet to us. They said, no, you're not in the right place. And they got this very old truck out, stuck all our luggage on the back of the truck, put us in the front. I don't know how he got us all in, because there were three of us. And Lucy was big, Jim was tall, and I was where I am now. And a Chinese person. And he drove us to this hotel. So then again, we get the luggage dropped at the hotel, and I go into the reception where I faxed them two or three times, just saying, you know, we are on our way, we're coming over. There's nobody in the reception, there's nobody around anywhere. I'm thinking, you know, this is really a bit strange. So I start going looking around the hotel and around the place, and finally find a man and say to him, hey, you know, we're supposed to be checking in. What is this? Where is everybody? Oh, he said, the hotel's not open yet. This was 2 o'clock in the morning by then. So we finally got them to raise the manager and we persuade the manager to find us another hotel and take us there, which was halfway back to the airport again. I think we finally got to the hotel at 3 o'clock in the morning, so we were pretty glad of a ride, and the next morning we were glad we were going to be staying about 3 days in Phuket. One of which was a trip to the Golf and Country Club, and I think you've got a picture of it in your brochure. But it was fascinating because we were asking, obviously being into golf, about hiring golf carts and that sort of thing. Oh no, we don't have golf carts. We have caddies.
Yeah.
So we were asking about this and they said, yeah, well you see what we do here is you have a caddy to carry your gloves, a caddy to carry the umbrella, a caddy to fix the divots, and a caddy to rake the bunker. And then if you've got lots of money, you have a few more as well. That was a bit of an eye-opener.
Jokes on the boys.
Anyway, leaving Phuket, we just had a very quick overnight stop in Singapore because we've been there before and we didn't need to see it again. And then we took off and we went, and I've got to just quickly look at my... We were heading to Brunei, but on the way, we crossed Sarawak and Borneo. Borneo does have forests, just as dense as you can believe, and I honestly, seriously did think about the wild men, and I was pretty disappointed I didn't see one, but I guess it was a bit far down anyway. Then after that, the stop in Borneo was only for a very short time, but it was really fascinating because flying over it as we were still quite low, we got a fantastic view of the Sultan's Palace and the mosques and everything else. And their rooms really are gold, and it's apparently solid gold. Wow, so that's why you've got a picture of that on your next page for the one who's sitting over there.
Mm-hmm.
And from Brunei, we were heading to Manila, and to get to Manila we flew over the Palawan Passage, the Balabac Strait, the Calmian Islands, and the tip of Mindoro. And then we got to Manila in the Philippines, which four people have seemed to have a lot of mud in the last few weeks. Manila was absolutely fascinating because we were met by two very elderly ladies, and they took care of us. They were just like, they were just all nice, cuddly people. And they gave us tea and cakes and all sorts of stuff while we waited for the plane to be refueled. And it turns out that these cuddly old ladies are two of five sisters, and the two sisters own not only the Beechcraft dealership but also the San Miguel Brewery. So they weren't very stupid old ladies. Anyway, we got back to the plane, and that was a bit of a ooch. Somebody had left a switch on, and the battery was flat. So it then took, I don't know how long, but quite a long time to find the right size generator to get a jump start. Oh, we didn't get a jump start, it was okay. We got off. Flying on to Hong Kong. So it's been quite a long day by then. We get to Hong Kong and it's dark. And Hong Kong is, I know some of you probably live there, so you know it. And you know the old airport, and we're still talking about the old airport when we're talking landing in Hong Kong. And it is a bugger. It's very scary, very frightening, and it's very short runway. And the instructions are, fly around the skyscrapers, and when you get to the Epsom sign, make sure you're level with it, and you'll be okay, but if you're lower or higher, you'll crash. When we actually got out of the plane and saw where we were at the end of the runway with a mountain smack in front of us, poor Jimmy. that was one of the most scary things that we did actually, you know, it's not lots of them. We had a couple of days in Hong Kong and I went on to Taipei, Taiwan, and used to have another meeting with Kunan, golf producers. Jim and I went to the hotel and had lunch. And lunch was most marvelous. I suppose you'd call it Chinese buffet, whatever it was a buffet lunch, and there were just all sorts of exciting things to eat. I wasn't terribly hungry, so I chose something that looked a little bit like tiny, really baby romaine lettuce and spaghetti. And while Jim and I were talking, I'm a very slow eater, and I always sort of carried my fork around the plate. And suddenly, I was looking at this plate and I thought, excuse me, there were two eyes looking at me. And then I looked at all these spaghetti and I thought, oh my god, that's not spaghetti, that's either worms or jelly, eels or, anyway, whatever it was wiggles. I didn't get much lunch after that, I didn't get fancy anymore after that. But anyway, so, continuing our journey, the next day we went on to Japan. Japan is the only country I know that we're not allowed to land in the capital. So we had to land in Nagoya, get the bullet train to Tokyo. We spent a couple of days in Tokyo, and we even actually landed on the way around the metro with the help of some Chinese kids, and other Chinese, Japanese kids. I'm not saying help of, but if I didn't know where I was going, I was absolutely fascinated. I'd go up to a young, like around about 15-year-old, and I'd say, in English, can you please tell me how to get to? And they'd say, oh sure, of course. And they'd take me there and show me, and spoke perfect English. So the Japanese speak a lot of English, the kids anyway. Jim was fascinated. He was there with us for a day, and when he had Jim like this, and all of the Japanese people like this, and they were all looking up at him, thinking, what is that? It was quite interesting. Having finished our trip in Tokyo, we went on and met him. He'd flown the plane up to Sapporo, which is on the other island, the North Island. And another day he had been shipped out especially by Beechcraft. And this time it seems that Jim had managed to get it installed and done right. The only thing is, when something like that happens, and I'm sure some of these flyers and pilots and stuff here will understand what I'm talking about. When you've had a fairly serious problem with a plane, you request a test flight to make sure that it's going. So we requested please to fly the plane to make sure that it was going, because we then had Russia and Siberia fly over, and it was a very long way with nothing. If we'd fallen out of the sky, we would have been lost forever. The Japanese categorically refused this permission to test fly. They said, either you take your slot now or you'll be here for the next 2, 3, maybe 4 weeks. Get out. So, we took to the air. What else could we do? Jim got up and a little bit away from the Japanese island before he grinned at us and said, actually, don't worry, I was able to manually test it and I knew it was working, but I just wanted to give them a long time. Anyway, we flew over part of Russia to start with and stopped to refuel at a place that's got two names on the world maps, and so I'm going to tell you both. It's called either Chabarovsk or Khabarovsk, depending on which map you're looking at, but it's the same place. The captain of the port came out to visit us, great big guy, all gold epaulettes and everything else, because it was the quite a special balloon. It's found a private plane that actually landed at their airport. Several of the staff came out and actually to visit, and were told very smartly, foreign territory, you can't go in there, and the door was blocked. But the captain just said, oh, go away, and he came on board and chatted with us until we left again. He was an absolute sweetheart. Then we left, the next stop was a place called Magadan. Magadan is Siberia. And, well, the only, I suppose the only downfall about that one was that there was a girl being in the plane, and I happened to be, unfortunately, a little bit close to her when she took the model out of the plane, and all the diesel fuel went pouring into my shoes. Sounded like hell, I had to throw them away, man. Anyway, after that, it's night time, but it's very short night time because it's summer and we're flying north, so there's not much night time. John was very tired, so he went and sat in the back, and I went and sat in his seat. And the sun was streaming through the windscreen, and I thought, oh gosh, this is absolutely smashing. And I was supposed to be sitting there keeping Yeshi happy and awake while he was flying the plane. And of course, the next thing I know, somebody's shaking me on my shoulder saying, go and make us coffee, and I'd be flat out of sleep. How long we thought about that one. Anyway, we've still got a long way to go, even after all that. Magadan, looking for the Bering Strait. 7.5 miles up. You can see a long way. And when we did see the Bering Strait, it looked like a little narrow band of ribbon. Wow, that's the Bering Strait. I thought it was bigger than that. And when we got to it, even when we got right over it, it still didn't seem that really big. And I could understand how the American Indians may perhaps come from Siberia, because they're quite Siberian looking. Because it wouldn't, I don't think, even that far to row across. It could have been done. But still, flying there, knowing at that point that was the longest trip we've done, or the longest leg of our journey that we've done in one go, I knew that we were flying off students. Masses of icebergs flying below us, and me thinking, well, we wouldn't last even a minute if we did have to land in it. But thank goodness, mine is right on the edge of the other side, and we managed to get there and land. And we had a lovely welcome, all these lovely little Alaskan kids. Well, we didn't stop there very long. We just refueled and went on to Anchorage, where we stayed the night. And from Anchorage the next morning, we flew to Seattle. And from Seattle, we were on the Homewood Strait to Phoenix. So, when we get as far as overhead Phoenix on the approach, we call the control tower and ask, could we have a flyby? I don't know if any of you know what a flyby is. Some of you know what a flyby means. A flyby means that instead of landing, you don't put your landing gear down, but you go down to within like this much of the ground, and you scream all the way down the runway, and then boom, take off again, fly around the airport, then you put your landing gear down and come down and land, which is what we did. And I think it was probably the biggest rush of my life. And then the crowning point was arriving at the airport, and they've got one of these what do you call them, those things that are lit up with messages on them. Yeah, but like ticker tape, it's all done in light. And it says, congratulations, GCN family, welcome home. Oh, no. That's it, that's all I've got to say. Yeah, if anybody wants to ask questions, please feel free.